indeed an honor and also a great pleasure to deliver tonight's lecture on the legacy of Garrett Fitzgerald and further questions and ideas. To be able to honor his memory in a way that we know he would have liked best, through the power of words and fate. But it's also a challenge, because I'm speaking to an audience who have their own memories of Garrett, his friends, his former colleagues, and those who interlinked with him in so many aspects of his varied and diverse life. And it's a pleasure tinged with sadness. Sadness that Garrett isn't with us tonight, except in our memories of him. At least we can be sure that these memories are so vivid that they won't fade. And I know, even as I'm saying memories, each of us has vivid memories, because that's what Garrett was like. Vivid memories of stories, of parties, of some people's journeys to France and elsewhere, of his enthusiasm in lectures, and all of those aspects of the person that we honor with this spring school here in UCD. And Garrett died, I said that he was a moral as well as a political leader of great integrity. He was a deeply spiritual man who lived his values and gave up his time and boundless energies in high political office, and always did so with a great sense of humor, sometimes even a sense of fun. He was so enthusiastic. And we must remember the constant support he enjoyed from his beloved wife, Joan, the real politician, as she was fondly called. As I recall, the day would go by without calls between the two of them, even if they weren't very far apart. In his long and very active retirement, Garrett acted as a guide and mentor to this country he loved so much through his writing, broadcasting, and public speaking here and around the world. I believe that the incredible outpouring of public affection on news of his death was because he had in fact become a wise grandfather to the country, whom we listened to or not, but knew was there to offer advice. Garrett died at a time when a goal he had done so much to achieve, peace on our island, was sealed by a highly successful state visit of Queen Elizabeth. There's no doubt that when historians assess the history of Ireland over the last half century, Garrett Fitzgerald's name will be held in the highest esteem for many reasons, and most of all for his dedication in seeking a lasting solution in Northern Ireland. It was a strange thing to say at the time, but I remember expressing my own thoughts by saying that he gifted us with the timing of his death, because he grounded that historic state visit in the substance of the long road to peace in Northern Ireland. And there was a linking of the ceremonial, which was so compelling, the symbols, with the long struggle. The Sunningdale Agreement came just after his appointment as Minister for Foreign Affairs. He wasn't daunted by the collapse of that agreement, nor by many further setbacks along the road to peace. As Minister in Taoiseach, he worked tirelessly on three strands which he knew had to be addressed: relations between the two communities in Northern Ireland, between North and South on this island, and between Ireland and Britain. I only had one public disagreement with Garrett. I had a number of private disagreements, but I only had one public disagreement, and that was over the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 1985. I had admired Garrett for his links with the Unionist community and for his willingness in many ways to go the extra mile in discussions. And yet, it did seem to me at the time that the agreement was in a way rushed, both by Garrett and by Margaret Thatcher, for their own reasons. And that for once, there had not been even an adequate attempt at consultation with the Unionist community. And I think we all remember the outrage and the sense of being betrayed that many in the Unionist community expressed at that time. What I came to figure out later was that Garrett had a good sense of being innovative in institutions, and that what the Anglo-Irish Agreement was putting forward was an innovative way of addressing those three dimensions, the two communities in Northern Ireland, north and south of this island, between Ireland and Britain, and therefore it was breaking the mould of what had gone before. And of course his efforts were not in vain. The crusade which Garrett started and developed was taken up and brought to fruition by those who came after him. I think we've become so used to the peaceful conditions here on the island of Ireland that it's easy to forget how bad things had become. In 1974, the year after Gareth Fitzgerald was appointed Minister for Foreign Affairs in William Cosgrave's government, 294 people lost their lives in the conflict in Northern Ireland. Every day brought terrible news of deaths and injuries. The part which Gareth played in bringing an end to that dreadful situation is something that his country will never forget. Foreign Affairs was Gareth Fitzgerald's first portfolio, and he took to the job with gusto and the enthusiastic intelligence which was a hallmark of his period, both as minister and teacher. Even though I recall him muttering at the time that he had hoped that he would get the portfolio of finance, since he had been the spokesperson on finance. He had any number of issues to tackle in his new role. Ireland's first presidency of the European Union was looming. There was a pressing need to build up a foreign service to match Ireland's growing role in international affairs. In the tributes that were paid to Garrett on his passing, full recognition was made of his contribution to strengthening Ireland's foreign policy globally. Indeed, it can be said that he was the first foreign minister to bring foreign policy into the central position it should and does occupy today. He also brought many bright young people into the department, inspired by his vision of an Ireland that could hold its own in Europe and more broadly. And he brought bright young people into public service, which is very important for any country. I'd like to mention one aspect which Garrett devoted a significant amount of time to, his concern for the developing world. On being appointed minister, Garrett made it clear that improving Ireland's performance in delivering official development assistance to the poorest countries in the world was one of his top priorities. Again, it's useful to recall what went before. Until 1973, Ireland had a poor record on official development assistance. Private donations were always generous, and Irish missionaries made a huge contribution in the fields of education and health. But governmental aid, that is, support for long-term projects and disaster response, was extremely small. Garrett Fitzgerald changed all that. Within months of taking office, he established the Agency for Personal Services Overseas, APSA. Even more importantly, he committed Ireland to joining the group of developed nations determined to reach the United Nations target of spending 0.7% of their GNP on helping the poorest countries. It would be, we have to admit, a long time before Ireland came close to reaching the 0.7 target, but the goal was set. Garrett even managed to persuade his colleague, the Minister for Finance, Richie Ryan, to allocate the first £1 million to get a proper aid programme going. Garrett was also a great friend of the developing countries on the European stage. When Ireland took over the EU presidency in 1974, he inherited the challenge of finalising the Lome Convention. And I particularly remember him talking about how important this was going to be, the challenge of it, and that Ireland as a country could give leadership. It was something that he talked about quite a lot, and it's something that perhaps we should remember in these rather dark and depressing days, that we have to also remember to lift our sights and, as Garrett did, find that it is possible for a small country to punch above its weight during a presidency and to address issues that are important on the European stage as well. But it was because he saw the perspective of developing countries. He understood the challenges, the lack of capacity, the need to ensure that agreements were as fair as possible. The Lome Treaty, which was of such importance to the African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries, both in aid and trade terms, was supposed to have been finalised before Ireland took over the reins. In the event, it wasn't ready, and thorny issues remained to be resolved. Garrett took to the negotiations, tough negotiations with the ACP partners on the one hand, but perhaps even tougher with his new fellow members on the European side, because he was trying to be as fair and to see the perspective of developing countries. He took to it as if he'd been dealing with the issues all his life. In his autobiography, he paints a vivid picture of the last-minute negotiations on the convention and the extraordinary effort that had to be put in to achieving the agreement. But once again, he was successful and a treaty was agreed which would bring far-reaching benefits to many developing countries. It was known widely that Joan had a fear of flying herself and wasn't happy that Garrett was flying so much. One of his hobbies, as some of you will know, was railway timetables. But I recall attending a conference, I think it was in Ditchley Park, and probably on some European theme. I do recall this, that an announcement was made as follows. Our keynote speaker, Minister Garrett Fitzgerald, missed his flight, but he will be arriving earlier by train. The theme of this UCD spring seminar is not only to look back at Garrett Fitzgerald's legacy, but also to look ahead at questions and challenges, particularly in the context of reflecting about democracy. I'd like to focus briefly on one challenge which I believe to be of the utmost importance, and which I know Garrett would also be concerned with. And that's the need to respond to climate change and to ensure that the international response is a fair one, which takes account of the position of the poorest countries. Addressing climate change follows on from and is closely linked to Garrett Fitzgerald's concern for developing countries. It's those poorest countries which have done least to damage the environment, which stand to lose most as a result of global warming. The past 50 years have seen significant economic growth in the world economy, enabling hundreds of millions of people to improve their living standards and escape from poverty. Yet, while the proportion of people suffering from hunger has fallen over the last 50 years, the absolute number has risen, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly since the turn of the century. In 2008, this number exceeded 1 billion for the first time in history. An incredible indictment of how we order our affairs. With a billion people suffering from undernutrition, tackling hunger remains one of the most important challenges we face. To the burden faced by families desperately trying to combat undernutrition and food insecurity has been added the burden of climate change. Climate change is one of the key drivers of change affecting the food system and contributing to rising prices. Rising sea levels, drought, floods, storms, and increasing temperatures are already a reality. I believe that it's our task, and it's a democratic task of individual responsibility as well as state responsibility. It's a task as citizens of a world made rich by fossil fuel powered growth to minimize the impacts of climate change on the most vulnerable. We need a twofold approach, taking seriously the urgent need to reduce our own carbon use and supporting developing countries and communities to adapt their livelihoods, protect their resources, and embrace low-carbon development. The interesting thing is that it's not just a government-to-government or agency-to-agency idea, or even though the business community has a significant role to play. It's actually a deeply personal involvement, and we all can reuse, reduce, recycle, as my friend Vangari Mathai would say. So we can take this as part of citizenship, that we are citizens of the world, as well as citizens of our local community, of our country. This is the focus of my foundation, Mary Robinson Foundation Climate Justice. We define climate justice as linking human rights and development to achieve a human-centered approach, safeguarding the rights of the most vulnerable and sharing the burdens and benefits of climate change and its resolution equitably and fairly. The poorest people in the world are being forced to deal with the impacts of crises they played no part in creating. The 50 least developed countries are responsible for less than 1% of the greenhouse gas emissions. Increase in climate variability will lead to a reduction in time between severe storms, flooding, and droughts, affecting the ability of families and communities to recover from shocks. So what can be done to remedy this situation? A key step which must be taken is for all nations, and I stress all nations, to sign up to and ratify an international, equitable, legally binding agreement on climate change. A legally binding deal on climate change is the only meaningful way forward. Without a legally binding agreement, there's no obligation to act. Without a global agreement that includes all countries, there's a risk that the voices of the most vulnerable won't be heard, and that the biggest polluters won't do their fair share. Negotiations towards such an agreement have been long and hard, as you'll be aware. The annual conferences of the parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change have often been fractious events. The most recent of these meetings was held in Durban at the end of 2011 and delivered a commitment to develop, and I quote, a new protocol, another legal instrument, or an agreed outcome with legal force, which all countries would abide by 2015, which would come into force by 2020. There are many who believe that 2020 is too late to bring us to a trajectory to stay below 2 degrees Celsius, but nonetheless, the timeline and the commitment is there. What was critical in achieving this reasonably good outcome was an alliance between the European Union, the least developed countries, and the small island developing states. And this put significant pressure on the naysayers to stand aside and let progress be made. Garrett would not only have approved of this alliance, he would have seen the potential in it for the European Union to lead in tackling food security and hunger in the context of getting an overall inclusive agreement, which has necessary elements of equity, which recognizes the right to development of poor countries and poor peoples, and which tackles the burden sharing envisaged in common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. I can almost see the article he would have written in the Irish Times, because that alliance between the European Union, the least developed countries, and the small island states is very significant. I had the opportunity to discuss it with Connie Hedegaard the other day in Brussels, and to give her tribute for being able to bring about that alliance. It positions the European Union in a way that it has huge potential, and Ireland can, I believe, give some leadership in that context. The conference in Durban was the longest in history, going on 2 days longer than expected, and the results it delivered are, I believe, important but not necessarily secure. It will only help to solve the problem if governments deliver on the promises that they have made. So my foundation will be pressing governments to meet the 2015 deadline, and we'll also continue to urge the priority be given to food and nutrition security and agriculture in the context of climate change. Ignoring or undervaluing the contribution we as citizens can make to food and nutrition security restricts our potential for innovation and our capacity to act. And we should reflect on Garrett's example. So often he saw the innovative way forward. For example, he believed in innovative institutions to address the complexity of peace in Northern Ireland. I would like to think and genuinely believe he would approve of some of the innovative ways in which we're trying to address climate justice issues. In all of the challenges we face, we can derive support from the example which Gareth Fitzgerald set for us. He faced formidable problems in his political career, finding a solution in Northern Ireland, steering Ireland's first years in Europe, and making a small country count alongside much bigger neighbours, laying the foundations of a development aid programme which has lasted for 40 years and has grown into a highly respected arm of Ireland's relations with the world. Today's challenges are of a different order. For Ireland, the main concern is how to track a course out of our economic crisis so that our children can have a standard of living that is as good as our European neighbours. But we also need to raise our sights and show leadership in areas where Ireland has credibility. Thanks to Garrett's early work, Ireland is well respected by developing countries who want to extend their trade links with us. At the same time, we could take a lead role in the alliance forged in Durban between the EU, developing countries, and small island states by developing innovative approaches to food and nutrition security and access to affordable energy for the poorest. This would be done in the context of forging a legally binding, inclusive climate agreement which is fair and equitable. We can draw inspiration from the memory of Gareth Fitzgerald, but I'm sure that he would have been the first to say And in the end, we must find the courage to take the necessary measures to face future challenges ourselves. Garrett was to all of us a man of many parts. He was the most wonderful and generous husband, father, grandfather, and friend. One of the things he loved was to be in the company of young people. And when I say young, I mean also very young, which isn't always the case with a man. You know, they sort of want children to be old enough to be able to converse or play chess or something. Could take any age. He had extraordinary attention to detail in his various professional careers, from Aer Lingus to Leicester House, his career as a lecturer, which was well written about this morning, and his love of research and figures and evidence-based planning for the future. But most people will recall him as a politician or a statesman. To me, he was definitely a statesman, and he defied the definition of a statesman given to us by Harry Truman, who said, and I don't like this quote, but I'll give it to you anyway, he said, "A politician is a man who understands government. A statesman is a politician who's been dead for 15 years." That's not good enough. He was a statesman for quite a long time during his life, and that, I think, was why he lifted us and why he gave us the that sense that he represented our better selves. We were fortunate to have such a wonderful statesman at an important time for our country. We have to try to live up to his principles, and I think this seminar is both a great idea, and I'm very happy to have launched it. Thank you very much.